On the air, let me just double check this here. Live on the air with Richard Chismar. Are you there?
I'm here, hey.
Oh, awesome. We can hear you. I can hear you. So you're listening to 93.3 FM WRFR LP in Rockland, Maine, 99.3 FM Camden, Maine, and streaming online at WRFR.org. Live on the air with Richard Chismar. Richard, how are you tonight?
I'm good, man. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm going to start doing interviews with this phone every time. It sounds way better. So we've got a brand new book coming. If before we get into all that, how about you go ahead and just explain to folks at home, why don't you give a brief introduction to who you are?
Who am I? Rich Chismar. I've been writing and publishing since 1988. I started a magazine called Cemetery Dance back in 88 when I was a senior in college. And, you know, we beat the odds and have stuck around for 30 plus years. And now the publication business has kind of taken a backseat for me. I've got a staff who handles all the hard work, and I've been focusing on writing for the last, 4 or 5 years.
Excellent. And you've been doing a lot of writing. You've done not only projects that you've done yourself, you've co-written with other people, including your son, Stephen King. You've had works with Jonathan Sheck. And Jonathan is an actor as well, right?
He is. Yeah. John and I grew up like three blocks away from each other, and he, both have the same background, same working class town, same neighborhoods. His dad was a cop. My dad was a Air Force guy. And, all these years later, he went out to Hollywood in college. And, all these years later, we kind of reconnected and started writing together and had 4 or 5 different, things produced out in, television and movies. And, great guy. He's had a great career, and, love working with him.
One thing that I can say would be looking forward to sometime in the future, if this Talisman movie ever gets made, you and Jonathan did a Black House script, and that would be pretty cool to have a movie of, I'm going to say.
Yeah, I mean, that would be a blast. We wrote Black House. We wrote a draft of Black House for Akiva Goldsman, who was like, Academy Award-winning director, writer, producer. He's done a bunch of big films, Beautiful Mind with Russell Crowe, and Cinderella Man with Russell, and he's done several Stephen King projects, and just a really talented guy. So the fact that he hired two schmucks out of Edgewood, Maryland was a cool thing for us. Who knows whether that script will resurface, or in Hollywood they'll just hire someone and pay them a whole bunch more money to do a new one.
And for anybody that wants to know the script that we're talking about, it did actually get released, at least in a limited edition, the little silver book, right?
Right, from Borderlands Press.
Right.
Yeah, and that was kind of a neat thing, because we had no plans to do that. And then I get a lot of, personal messages from people asking if they can read a draft. And I always am, protective of it, because it's based on something from Steve King. So I always, very politely say, I'll have to see if I can get permission. And, it was just kind of a neat situation where I asked Steve and Peter Straub if they were okay with it, and they both okayed it, and people got a chance to read it.
Excellent. It's interesting, because it's one of those things where, we see interviews with Stephen King where he says things like, I'm not really big on writing sequels, but it's like, but you've done a number of sequels. So, right. In his movies, a lot of his movies get sequels, and maybe that's because he doesn't like to write them himself, way back, I have Pet Sematary 2 that a lot of people don't even know exists. And I watched it again for the first time since I was a kid, about 2-3 weeks ago. And I was like, man, you know what? I still really like this movie. everybody really dumps on it, but I really like that movie in ways. It has some pretty big name actors, and it was a really good sequel to the movie that got put out back then. So
it's got Clancy Brown.
From Shawshank. I used to go, that movie was actually one of the ones that made him scary to me. It was Pet Sematary 2. But yeah, I mean, you watch Shawshank Redemption. I think he's possibly scarier in Shawshank Redemption than in most films because he's so real. He's just this real prison guard that you know is a real guy somewhere.
He's the human monster in that film.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
that's terrifying.
Yeah.
It's so believable.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you've got to really immerse yourself in the Stephen King world. I mean, you've had other projects, of course. I just found out that you did Roadhouse 2, which
our very first film John and I did together. Yeah, that was John. They actually hired John as an actor and for that film and paid him a bunch of money. And then, like a week after they started, he calls me and he's like, "Rich, you know, they need us to rewrite this thing." And I was like, "John, you know, we're supposed to be like, you know, horror thriller writers." And he's like, "Well, it's just a rewrite. We'll get paid, you know, a good nice paycheck, and we won't even have our names on it because we're just rewriting." And then, sure enough, our names get plastered all over it. So.
Yep.
That was crazy.
Yeah, that's crazy because I remember, and this is going to sound terrible, but I remember watching the first one when I was a kid. My mom didn't really preview things before we watched them. So Jean-Claude Van Damme, you know, Charles Bronson, Steven Seagal, Kurt Russell, Patrick Swayze, like all those. I just saw them, you know, and I was like, okay. And I grow up now and I'm like, oh my God. I'm not letting my kids watch these.
If Patrick Swayze was in the sequel, I would walk around with a t-shirt, you know, saying, "Hey, I wrote the sequel to Roadhouse." But unfortunately, he was not. And instead, you know, I kind of saved that for sometimes I get these just embarrassingly, extravagant introductions when I do a speaking engagement or something, or I show up at a convention and they introduce me and they, you know, they're blowing air, you know, and making me look good. And I get up there and I say, don't believe it. I wrote the sequel to Roadhouse too. And, you know, and that immediately kind of makes everyone relax.
Yeah. I mean, it could go the other way though. You could go into a very prestigious place and they could just say writer of Roadhouse 2.
Yes.
And you'd be like, and that'd be okay.
People show up at signings with the Roadhouse DVD. I've signed quite a few of those.
That's funny. Yeah. So you just are working on getting this new book out, which is super exciting, Chasing the Boogeyman. I've been really excited to read this because of the whole premise, which I'll let you go ahead and give kind of a description of what this book is kind of about.
I've had trouble, you know, finding a short version, so I'll do my best. But essentially, I grew up in a little working class town in Maryland called Edgewood, and had a really kind of an idyllic childhood. You know, lots of close friends. This is back when, you know, no one locked their doors and windows, and you could, you know, you could go out at night and play kick the can and not come home until after dark, and your parents didn't have to worry about where you were, that kind of thing. And I always knew I would, you know, that I wanted to go back and write a novel set in this place and during my youth. But I always figured it'd be a hard novel. I always figured it would be like It or, you know, Dan Simmons' Summer and Night. And instead, what came to me was this very, very non, you know, supernatural traditional horror type of an idea. And what it was based on is there was a series of break-ins. Like I said, it was a you know, really nice little town, but there was a dark side. And in '88, there were a series of break-ins where an unknown assailant would break in at night, usually through unlocked windows or doors. And he would touch sleeping women. You know, he would caress their hair, or he would touch their arm or their leg. And then when they woke up, he would take off. And this guy did this over like 30 times, was never caught until many years later for a different crime in Baltimore City. So the short version is that I've always wanted to write about that. It kind of changed the town for a time. You know, people bought guns. People, it was like a serial killer type movie, even though he wasn't killing people. And to my young warped brain, I always wondered what would happen if he started, you know, being violent or killing these women. So that's it. It's, you know, it's a traditional kind of a campfire story. I moved home for 9 months after I graduated from college because I was, you know, preparing to get married and my wife was still in school. So we saved some bucks and it was just a very interesting time and a very interesting dynamic to be, you know, 22 years old and living in the house you grew up in the bedroom you grew up in, and having dinner with your parents. And it was a time that was kind of ripe for my imagination. And I was working on the first issue of the magazine, et cetera, et cetera. So that's, the book is essentially about what's happening in town while I'm back at home and how I kind of get tangled into the whole mess. But in Chasing the Boogeyman, he's actually killing girls and not just caressing them in the night. So it gets pretty dark pretty quickly.
Yeah, that's actually pretty scary when you think about it. I actually had a friend just a couple days ago post like a repost from one of her friends and said that in up here in Portland, the girl was in her bedroom and this random guy walked in. It was like 2:30 at night, walked into her bedroom and she screamed. And I don't know if it was her boyfriend or her roommate came out of the other room. And when the guy saw the other guy, he took off running. And
yeah.
They, you know, I mean, this just happened here. So it's not an outside of the box idea to think of something like this can happen, because it happens all the time. Where people just invade other people's space, their privacy. Now, with that being said, have you ever had that kind of a thing happen to you? You know, being that you're in kind of an elevated social status, have you ever had this kind of thing happen with you and your family?
Knocking on wood right now, as you ask me that. No, not so far. I mean, I've had a few unsettling, you know, incidents, but you know, no home invasions or anything like that. You know, we've got like lots of cameras and stuff up, so that's good. And you know, home alarms and all that, but yeah, no, I haven't. So I'm knocking on wood, because that's a terrifying thought, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And what struck me about what happened, you know, back in Edgewood back then is it wasn't until I revisited this idea that I realized it happened so many times. And in my mind, looking back, it, you know, maybe it happened a half dozen times or so, because that kind of makes sense that eventually the guy would wise up. But looking back through newspaper articles and talking to people, this, you know, no exaggeration, it happened over 30 times. And you talk about bold and also, you know, crazy. And like I said, he was never caught until the 90s. He was arrested in Baltimore City for something, and he admitted to it, and the evidence matched up, so they knew he was telling the truth.
It's crazy. Yeah, I mean, I even know a guy, something similar like that he had done. Like, I mean, I hung out with this guy with okay. friends, and then I find out, because then I got married, and my now ex-wife's aunt was like, yeah, you know, this thing happened, and she told me all about it. And I was like, what? I was like, that's crazy. She's like, yeah, he'd park his car a couple blocks down or whatever, and he'd walk over to the wedding dress shop, and he'd just peep in and just wait and whatever. I was like, that's weird. She's like, yeah, and he'd take off running. And I was like, that's so bizarre that this kind of thing happens. And in broad daylight sometimes, you know?
Yeah. And I think that's the thing. I think that's why it's touched the core. Just like, you know, the old Halloween movie, you know, it's a typical small suburban town, and I think, unfortunately, more often than not, these small towns have, you know, stories like this, you know, that are based in you know, fact as opposed to just legend. And so that's what I did. I kind of just took this old campfire story and played with it, and you know, my warped mind, I had a lot of fun doing it, I was going to say, because I got to revisit my past. I got to revisit my family and my friends and a more innocent time back in 1988. And yeah, I had a good time writing it.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned the like the old Halloween movies, right? Like mm-hmm. Michael Myers, one of the most iconic horror movie characters, villains, whatever you want to call him, of all right. time. If you got a chance, if John Carpenter said, hey, listen, can we talk about this? How would you feel? What would you do? You know, if you got a chance to work on one of those films, reimagine the character, what would you do with Michael Myers?
Oh, you know what? I don't know what I'd do with him, but I'd say yes really quickly. I did not learn my lesson from Roadhouse 2. So yeah, if they invited me on board to write like Halloween 16, I'm like, I'm there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what I would do with it, and that's probably the problem. I'd probably get fired from it because I am a traditionalist. So I would probably go back to the roots of the original story and my script would not be ripe for turning it into a music video, loud type of a horror film for today's audience. It would be much more like Carpenter's original, which to me is still the, it's still my favorite horror film. I'm not saying it's the best one I've ever watched, but it's my favorite.
Yeah, absolutely. It's my Halloween is my favorite, probably my favorite horror movie ever made.
Yes.
Favorite bad guy. I mean, I like Jason and Freddy's cool and Leatherface is neat, but a huge Clive Barker fan. So I'm reading Scarlet Gospels right now, I've been hearing a lot of people are trying to tell me that he didn't write it. And I'm like, I'm reading all kinds of interviews where he's talking about writing it. So I feel like maybe he did.
Anything possible, but Clive is he's so brilliant that I'd be shocked if he would let anyone else write something that had his name on it.
I mean, right. I mean, he got mad when people did Hellraiser movies and they sucked. So,
right.
Yes. And the word din, D-I-N, the word din, never heard it before a Clive Barker book, but I've heard it about 1,000 times since reading 3 of them. So it's like his favorite word, and it's in this book a lot. So
that's funny.
So Chasing the Boogeyman, like I said, I'm super excited. I haven't got a chance to read through it much yet, so I'm working on it. I've had a lot going on the last couple days, but this is a book that I've been looking forward to ever since you told us about it. We have multiple communities on the internet, Stephen King groups. You have groups devoted to cemetery dance, and there's tons of publishers, books of horror, and Rare King group and everything. So many people out there, and lots of commingling and separatists and whatever, but this book was announced months ago, and I know people are so excited for it. I mean, you have this really interesting community that is willing to buy your book repeatedly. Just to help.
I almost have to tell them to stop. Just because we're doing another giveaway or something.
And I know.
I'm very fortunate. I wake up every morning grateful for so many reasons, both personal and professional. But, some people have like nightmares associated with social media and the online, communities. But I've been really, really fortunate and seem to have, gathered together just a lot of, really kind people and a lot of very enthusiastic and supportive people. And I've always been, open and tried to, do book giveaways and things like that where there's nothing attached. But, in the case of Chasing the Boogeyman, I my publisher, Simon & Schuster, Gallery Books, and for the first time in a long time, I feel really, indebted to and responsible to, someone besides myself or my own company, Cemetery Dance. And I've worked really hard promoting the book, and it's been a great time doing it. But, I've been pretty relentless because, I want the book to do well for them. They believed in me and they paid me, a nice advance check. And I just, I want the book to do well for them. And like you said, I have some fantastic readers who sometimes have to say, no, don't buy another copy. I'll send you this bookmark for free.
Yeah. Yeah. And they are, I mean, like you said, your fans are great. Your staff is fantastic. I mean, anytime there's an issue of any sort, you've got like Mindy right on it. Boom. Here, let me fix that for you. Responsive and everything. And sometimes people don't understand that. I mean, with being a small publisher, there's delays,
right?
Certain things are outside you're not putting all the books together yourself. You don't have, in-house manufacturing necessarily for what you're putting out. So sometimes there are delays.
Oftentimes with us, and that's unfortunate, but it's, the good thing is we've been in business for over 30 years, so people trust us. The bad thing is, And people ask me, how do you do it all? And do it successfully? And I'm like, well, I don't, you know, lots of mistakes, just, you know, just like year one, year 35 or whatever this is, you know, lots of mistakes that still occur and you just do your best not to repeat them. And, you know, many times the delays are my fault because, you know, they're waiting for my approval on this and I'm not going to have time to read it until a week from Wednesday or I'm not going to have a chance to look at the dust jacket to approve it until, you know, the weekend. And sometimes, you know, and this is how it's always been, you know, sometimes there are, you know, really simple, legit reasons why something's delayed, but we're not going to tell you what it is because we don't want to come down on the artist who has, you know, who is 6 months late on the art. We don't want to come down on the writer who's been, you know, sitting, the autograph sheets for the book have been sitting on his dining room table for 4 months. We kind of keep that all in house, but again, you know, that's one aspect that we always strive to do better, but you're right. Mindy and Brian and Dan and Brady and the other Dan, great people. And they work their, you know, backsides off to do well for us.
Yeah. And I want to thank them as well, because I've had, things here and there that I've just needed some sort of help with. Brian sent me a book. You know, I was looking for something and he ended up sending me a book and that I didn't have yet. And, you know, without charge. Mindy's handled email questions for me. She's, you know, she's handled issues. So, I mean, you have a really fantastic, responsive team. So, you know, I know that those of us that have the chance, the opportunity to work with you in one fashion or another, really appreciate that type of support that you get from them.
Yeah. I appreciate you saying that. Cause, you know, they get a good amount of praise, but as in any business, any, you know, customer related business, you get plenty of complaints too. And, yeah, they work hard. I mean, I thank them at the end of every book I write and, you know, essentially for watching the store while I'm off playing and doing something a lot more fun than what, you know, they're doing all day. Although they all enjoy it, you know, and they've made, that's the cool thing. A lot of these customers, a lot of these readers have turned into friends after all, you know, after 30 years. And I know they appreciate that side of it too.
Yeah, definitely. Now with, we talked about the online communities. You are actually amazingly responsive as well for being as busy as you are. I mean, you have a family, you have children in school, sports, you have the writing projects, you have sometimes you write movies, sometimes you've done directing pieces as well.
Right.
But you're still online and still answer when somebody tags you in something, even if it's a thumbs up or an actual comment or a conversation. You always seem to be there for people, which I think is really refreshing in an age where people have kind of pushed their fans off, because I know it's difficult. You know, never read the comments is one of the biggest things I hear from people. But you do read the comments. How do you manage that? How can you do all this busyness and still manage to read comments and not get discouraged at times?
You know what? I've got thick skin, and 99% of the comments are so positive or, you know, very, very, like I said, for whatever reason, I've attracted a really great group of readers and people. You know, I had to be dragged onto social media, you know, kicking and screaming years ago. I'm kind of a recluse. I don't get out much. I don't go to many conventions. I don't go to many book conferences, that kind of thing. So social media, once I was introduced to it, was kind of a neat way to let people get to know me a little bit better, my family, to a certain extent, and also get to know them and exchange ideas and recommendations and all the fun stuff, you know, talking about books and sports and movies and, you know, all that good stuff. And, if I had had more negative, you know, experiences, I'm sure I wouldn't be as responsive as I am. But after all these years, it's like I said, they've been few and far between. So, it's been easy and it's been fun. And to me, it's important. I mean, I'm very grateful. I grew up, you know, writing my little monster and war stories and dreaming about becoming a writer. So there are very few days where that's not in my mind that, Hey guy, you're actually getting to live your dream. And people are actually reading your stories and responding to them and connecting with them. So yeah, I, you know, if someone gives me a compliment, you're darn right. I want to make sure that I'm there to say thank you and I appreciate it. And, you know, if somebody has a question, it's, you know, even if it's a tough question, you know, I always do my best to answer it. And yeah, I, you know, the short answer is that I enjoy it and I've got a bunch of good people. So it they make it a pleasure.
That's excellent. You've done so many giveaways. I mean, every time you've got a book out, like every week, you seem to be giving something away or doing some sort of a promotion to put somebody's name in or everybody's name in for giveaways for different types of books. Sometimes they're your books, sometimes they're signed Stephen King books, or I think you had one where you had an option for like a Richard McCammon book or something like that. Mm-hmm. So that's really neat. So for anybody who doesn't know, I mean, you give away so much and
it's fun. I mean, I again, to reinforce what I said about the kind of, you know, the quality of the people and the readers who you know, are kind of part of the community. The best part is, I mean, you know, I love giving stuff. I love, you know, back in the day, getting free books, you know, there was almost nothing better. You know, I get a free book, you know, to review in the magazine or just because, you know, they liked the magazine or they enjoyed my work. It always put a smile on my face. So I remember that. I love to do it for others. But the neatest thing for me is immediately as soon as I announce the winner, there are dozens and dozens of people who are congratulating the winner and saying how happy they are for them. And you're going to love this book or, you know, it's just a neat thing to see. And I enjoy doing it.
Yeah. That's one of the coolest things about all the communities that I've joined so far is that every time somebody wins something, there might be a little like, oh man, I didn't win. But at the same time, oh, can you hear me? Richard?
Yeah,
I got there. We go. Sorry about that. One of the neatest things about the communities that I've joined online is that every time somebody does win, as you were saying, there's so much outpouring of support for, you know, congrats, congratulations, hey, way to go. Even when there's still those like, oh man, I didn't win again. At the same time, you've got so much more congrats to that person and thank yous and it's really neat to see that. And sometimes, you know, sometimes when people give away a book, other people sprout up and they said, hey, I've got one to give away too. And, you know, and that gets to happen. It's really neat to see this like pay it forward attitude among these communities.
It's my favorite part. And before I forget, you know, I did want to give a shout out to the Stephen King Constant Readers fan club because they're a big group. I mean, I think it's 70 or 80,000 people.
Like 85,000 now.
Yeah, there you go. And they, you know, it's for a guy who's actually written with Steve King and then written about his, you know, world by myself. You know, I'm certainly conscious of the fact that there could be plenty of them who would be like, you know, who the heck does this Chismar guy think he is? And you know, walking in Stephen King's footsteps and all that kind of thing. But they've been really supportive, not only of the you know, the King related projects, but also, you know, Chasing the Boogeyman and other books that I've written and the business in general. So yeah, that's again, another example, but that's a big group and, you know, the moderators have been great and all the members have been great. And, I'm just, you know, there's another Stephen King rare book page or something like that. And the same thing, they're just very accepting. And, I appreciate that. And I try to tell them from time to time and do not sound too corny, but, I am grateful and I do appreciate it. And the nice thing is, you know, every once in a while, someone will post and be like, oh my God, you know, Chismar, he wrote, you know, and I'm just like, guys, I'm right there with you. I'm a constant reader. I'm a fan. And, you know, I just, you know, I'm happy to be part of the group where I belong.
Now, I think that that's one of the most exciting parts I would feel anyway, is that you got to co-write a book with Stephen King, but then you got to do a continuation of that all by yourself. And and now, because originally you did, you had Gwendy's Button Box, and I remember you giving kind of a story when I saw you in Bangor, where you'd said that, you know, he kind of started the story and then wasn't sure what to do and then kind of passed it over, and then and then you got to do it and thought, hey, we're gonna get to go back and forth, and then he was like, good job, and you're like, okay, get to put this book out now.
That's right.
And I thought it was really neat. I really enjoyed that book. I breezed through it so fast because it's already kind of short, but the margins are also really wide too.
Right.
So it's a very short book. So I was kind of expecting something like that when you did the sequel, Gwendy's Magic Feather, but it was much bigger. It was double, triple the size.
And yeah, it was double the size. Yeah. It was, it was. No, I was going to say almost, but no, you're right. It was double the size.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the 300-something pages instead of 160-something pages, but also the margins weren't quite there, you know, weren't quite the same tightness. And now you've got this third book coming out, which, by all accounts, appears that it's being co-written with Stephen King again. Can you tell me anything about that? Can you tell me what that co-writing process looks like?
You know, what is on the first book, we did trade back and forth a little bit, you know, several times. And especially with the ending, where we kind of worked on each other's work. Like you said, the second one was all me, other than the fact that Steve did edit it. And then this third one is a full length novel. It's, you know, it's certainly not it. But I think the, you know, it's the same trim size hardcover, and it's I think it's 400 pages this time. It was Steve's idea. You know, you brought up the idea of sequels before. You know, we never talked about doing a sequel to the first one. I woke up one morning with an idea and I texted it to him, and he essentially said, I'm going to be busy with Holly Gibney for the foreseeable future, but this is a brilliant idea and you need to write it. So that's how that happened. With the third one, he started texting me on a Sunday evening, you know, what do you think about this with Gwendy? And then, you know, the text got longer and with more excitement, and by the time we finished this text, you know, exchange, we had decided to block off some time and write book three together. So yeah, I mean, we just we traded this time, because it was, you know, a much longer project, we traded sections, you know, 40-50 pages each, and we went back and forth for a few months, and you know, finished the first draft, and then we let it sit there for a couple months while we each worked on other projects, and then we came back and revisited it, and each did a rewrite, and that was that. So yeah, it was, you know, it was the fact that it was Steve's idea, and he kind of, you know, shared his excitement with me and allowed me to jump on board again, made it really special.
Now,
you know,
I see a lot. I was going to say, I see a lot of talk online with people asking, you know, is this gentleman who passes off the button box in the first book and everything and makes his appearances here and there, is he in fact the guy, you know?
Right.
And I've seen that there's sort of been confirmation, but sort of not. Have you ever officially given like an absolutely this is the same man, or
no?
Never?
No. I haven't. And, you know, I think the most I've said is, you know, well, the initials, you know, that's quite a coincidence, because I've heard Steve say that before. But no, you know, I haven't. You know, we certainly delved into that, you know, in this third book. And the neat thing about this third book is, again, like I said, we're not talking about, you know, Needful Thing or It Length type of a novel. It's, you know, it's a full length novel, but it's, you know, maybe 400 pages in the book, I think. But we cover a lot of ground. You know, I won't give too much away other than to say, you know, not only Castle Rock takes center stage again, but Derry. We go to Derry, and we cover a lot of ground that, you know, that connects this book, obviously, to the first two in the series, but also, you know, an awful lot of other, you know, solo Stephen King projects that are, you know, kind of considered sacred ground. So it was, you know, a blast to work on with him. And it was just, you know, I texted him at some point in the process, and I'm like, this is why, you know, when collaborations work, it's so exciting. It's because you're just kind of passing the ball. You know, you're doing your thing, and then you're passing the ball to the next guy. And he's got to be up to, you know, meeting the challenge of where you went. and, you know, we didn't really tell each other where we were going. We just did our thing and sent it and said, your turn. And so that was neat. You know, it was slightly terrifying from time to time for me. But it was cool to try to keep up.
All right. Now I've got one question, and I think it's probably on everybody's mind. Every once in a while you talk about how you just got back from Stephen King's house, or you just met up with Steve. Molly, AKA the Thing of Evil, is she a run to you and wants you to give her a pat down type of doggy, or does she just say, just let me know when Rich leaves?
You know, here's the thing. I haven't seen Steve in a few years in person. We've spoken, we've traded countless emails and texts, and sent lots of pictures of our dogs to each other. But I haven't met Molly. I keep telling him, I'm like, look, you know, we're about to get another puppy and add it to our little pack. So we'll have three. And I keep telling him, you know, we need to introduce him. But when, you know, the last ball game I went to was pre-Molly, you know, that I went to with Steve. And, you know, last time I saw him down in Florida or up in Bangor, you know, it wasn't, there were no pups around. So, yeah, I have not met Molly, and I need to. And I look forward to that day.
For another story, ladies and gentlemen, you heard it right here. No Molly.
No.
Well, I mean, at this point, you don't even know that Stephen King exists anymore. I mean, you...
Yeah, no, it was definitely Stephen King, not Steve King, but Stephen King who I wrote, you know, Gwendy's Final Task with. And that's the cool thing, is it's like, you know, he'll send something over and you read it and it's just undeniable, and you just shake your head, and you know, at least I do. I just shake my head and I'm like, you know, first of all, man, he's still got it. You know, he's still, and sometimes I just want to say, how easily did that come to you? And I don't even ask. And then the second thing is that always strikes me is what the heck am I doing? You know, working on a story with the guy I grew up, you know, reading and idolizing, and you know, the one person that I could point to and say, if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't, you know, there would not be a Cemetery Dance, and I would not be, you know, writing these stories, because it was his work that opened the door for me.
Now, I want to shift gears just for a sec, because we were talking about chasing the boogeyman, and you actually have a little bit of a contest going on. Not just, you know, pre-order my book and, you know, get your name in, but you actually have a contest going on right now for anybody who wants to attempt to make a trailer, like a book trailer.
Yeah, we just announced that today. And I wish I would have announced it 2 weeks ago and given these poor people, you know, more than 2 weeks to do a professionally made little, you know, 1 or 2 minute little book trailer. But, and I'd had the idea probably 2 months ago, and was just busy with other things. So never really had time to kind of put my thoughts together. But sometime yesterday, I just thought, you know what, I'm going to do this. I think it would be, you know, I have two little book trailers made that are both wonderful. And of, you know, I think one has been viewed on Amazon. I mean, it's been multiple ads, but you add up the views and it's over 2 million views for this thing. And then the other one was more recent, so it doesn't have that many views, but it has quite a few. But yeah, I just thought, you know what, I'd love to get one more trailer, release it, you know, a week or so after the publication date of Boogeyman. And it would be neat to let someone do this, give them, you know, what is a fairly decent prize of, you know, $1,000 check and then $1,000 Cemetery Dance gift card. And pick one winner and run it, you know, use it for advertising, you know, throw it on my website and Cemetery Dance's website, so lots of people see it. And yeah, it just sounded like a lot of fun. So we're going to run with it. We just announced it this afternoon, and we've had about a dozen or so people who have requested to see the script and are excited. So we'll see where it goes.
Yeah. And when you really think about it, I mean, $2,000 for 2 weeks worth of work is pretty fair, you know, and that's if you take 2 weeks to get it done, right? So I think that's, yeah, I mean, it's exciting.
The little script is, you know, is about a page and a quarter, but it's a pretty ambitious page and a quarter. So I am curious the feedback, you know, that we're going to get, which, you know, might be, hey, can we do this instead of this? And, And you know, I'll be very agreeable to anything as long as it kind of keeps the integrity of the trailer. And like I said, see what we get. I hate the downside is I hate to think of someone doing it and me not picking them, and then they've done this work. But on the other hand, I've done that, you know, so many times through the years where right. you're doing the work, trying to take advantage of an offer. And it more times than not, it doesn't work out. But you know what? It's all experience and it's all knowledge gained. And it usually leads to good things in the future. So I just kind of look at it like that. But I'm excited about, you know, the idea.
Yeah, exactly. Now you've got these books coming. Do you have anything else planned? Do you have another book in the works that you haven't announced yet? You know, obviously you have to share any details if it's super secret, but
right.
You have anything coming?
I've got one thing that's kind of super secret and you know, lots of stories, and I owe a couple introductions to books for people and that kind of thing. But the next big book that I work on, I'm going to start in September once the dust kind of settles after Boogeyman's released. And it's, you know, I have two different things. I'm not sure whether I'm going to turn right or turn left. I can't say much about the one on the left. The one on the right is a sequel to Chasing the Boogeyman. And, you know, I can kind of feel myself being pulled that way, but I'm not sure if it's because I'm chasing the Boogeyman every day up to publication. You know, trying to promote it. So I'll know in about 3 or 4 weeks which one I'm going to tackle.
So then beyond these, I mean, you're a writer. Writers in general have a habit of being fairly reclusive, like you said, a lot of times anyway. Sometimes they're super social, and I think they put out books a little less frequently than the others.
Right.
How do you balance the writing part with your family life as well? How can you be a dad, husband, and whatever else while also, you know, working on this stuff all the time?
The one thing that helps is I'm almost always here. You know, I work from my home office 99% of the time now, so I'm always here. So, it's kind of like that scene in Stand By Me at the end that everyone talks about with Richard Dreyfuss, where, right. you know, the kids are waiting on him. My kids have been stuck waiting on me a few times and my wife also, but they understand and they're patient. And, you know, it's something I'm still learning is how to pace myself, because I wish I could be the guy who wakes up every morning and writes, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 pages and then moves on to other things for the day. But it's just never worked that way for me. Once I really get into a project, it kind of consumes me. And for, you know, those 2, 3, 4 months or whatever it takes to write it, you know, I'm kind of a mess. I'm kind of obsessed with it. And I'm right. You know, I'm taking my laptop into restaurants for lunch with my family, and they're rolling their eyes at me. And I've got it in the car when we're driving to a friend's house, because heaven forbid I might be able to knock out 3 paragraphs or, you know, if the idea comes for the next chapter, I've got my laptop there to get to work. So, the plus side of that is that instead of taking 6 months or 12 months to write a book, I can usually do it in half that time. You know, Boogeyman is 90,000 words plus, and the first draft was written in like 3 months, or under 3 months. And of course there were, you know, several revisions and, you know, further drafts, but the blood and guts of it was done in less than 3 months, which is great.
Well, I'm super excited to get to dig into this book a little bit more. I've worked on the first part of the book so far, and I'm really excited to see where it's going to go. Richard, we only have about 3.5 minutes left until the top of the hour station ID. Is there anything else that you'd like anybody at home to know?
No. I appreciate the fact that you had me on, and enjoy it. And if you do get a chance, that Chasing the Boogeyman comes out next Tuesday the 17th, and it should be in bookstores everywhere, independents and the chain stores and Amazon, all that. So my hope is that if you take a chance on it and grab it, find me on social media, let me know what you think. Thank you,
Richard. Thank you for coming on today. Always a pleasure to have you on. I hope you'll come back again soon.
Absolutely.
Teased a little bit about you being my co-host next time, but I'm serious. You send me some music and we'll torture the folks at home with what you want to play.
I'll do it.
And everybody at home will have to let us know if they want to hear that.
Sounds good. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Richard. Have a great rest of your night.
Thanks. You too.
Thanks. Take care. Bye-bye. There we are. There is our interview with Richard Chizmar promoting Chasing the Boogeyman, Gwendy's Final Task, Cemetery Dance, and so much more. I hope everybody had a good time listening to the interview. Please stick around. I have a whole another hour of music coming up for you right after our top of the hour station ID.